Welcome to Minnesota Court of Appeals. The third matter on our calendar this morning is,
Banerjee.
Banerjee. It is. I was reading the letters in the wrong order. Looks like both of counsel are here and ready to proceed. Just briefly, you'll have 15 minutes each for your principal argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time. As you approach the podium, make sure you give us your name and the party you represent so that we've got that for our recording. The podium does move up and down with a little toggle switch, so you can adjust that as suits you. Appellant, whenever you're ready, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Alexandra Lubisavlovich, LJUBISAVLJEVIC. I represent the appellant, Animesh Banerjee. This matter is brought before you on an appeal from a motion hearing in January of 2018. It was a contempt motion that the respondent brought seeking her share of equity in property that was divided in a divorce with an amended J&D of June 2016. My client agrees that he did not pay her that equity. However, he was offsetting it by taxes that the respondent owed him. In Judge Wall's findings, on paragraph 134, he creates a table that divides the party's assets and the debts. And he specifically says that he summarizes an equal distribution of the party's marital assets and marital debts.
And if I understand the record, at the time of the dissolution judgment, which was December of 2015, the tax assessments that are listed as debts, your client had actually paid those amounts already.
That's correct.
One in January of 2015 and another payment. So even though the tax forms, tax returns hadn't been filed, he had made those payments for tax year 2014 at the time this judgment was entered.
That's correct, Your Honor. He made those payments out of non-marital funds. And that's why that was divided in that paragraph 134, where each party owed $25,000 for federal taxes and $7,500 for state taxes. The argument of the respondent is that further down in that order, it talks about that if there's any future taxes due, that my client would be responsible for that. He does not deny that he would be. But that would be upon filing of the tax returns. So that actual debt of $32,500 was already known at the time that the judgment and decree was filed.
And so the tax returns that are in the record, I'm looking, for example, at Exhibit 103, which purports to be, I guess, the federal and state returns for 2014. Those were just drafts, right? They weren't filed, which is
correct.
Why they don't have dates on them.
That's correct.
Okay.
And that was another contention in that whole divorce that the respondent did not want to sign off on those taxes. She has her own arguments why. So it is our position that, pursuant to paragraph 134, that each party actually is responsible for that tax debt.
But that doesn't seem to have been carried. That table, I agree with the way you're reading the finding, but that table doesn't seem to have been carried forward into the conclusions of law.
Yeah, I understand that it
has.
Why
didn't someone make a motion back then about, I'm going to offset this because I paid it?
I believe at the time they had amended the findings once or twice.
Not in that respect.
Not in that respect. And I think that the reasoning of prior counsel was that table allocated the debts that had been paid and that they were going to, pursuant to that table, get paid in the future from the respondent. Similar argument for the vehicle that the parties owned, where my client was paying on that vehicle, and then later in that table, the debts allocated. I mean, I think the problem in all of this is that had the parties agreed to send this back to Judge while he would have been able to clarify what his intentions were on this matter, because it is erroneous and some of it is conflicting and ambiguous language from that chart to then further in the conclusions of law where they talk about...
Well, they just don't talk about the taxes in the conclusions of law. And I'm sure your argument is we are to read all of this together and try to put it together. I have a specific question about the car payments. The amount of money that he's asking for, I guess, two monthly payments to be credited to him? Is that right?
Yeah, the payments that he made until the J&D were signed. I mean, those were, I think, more than two payments, but the portion that he had
The court awarded just two payments, because he had made them after the judgment and decree.
That's correct.
At a time when the court had decided that wife was responsible for those payments.
That's correct. But he's actually seeking the payments that he made in the...
Leading up to, under the temporary order, or leading up to the, before December of 2015?
Correct, Your Honor.
And why is he entitled to that under the judgment decree?
Well, because that chart allocates all the equity to her in that vehicle based on the payments that he's made. And so he's paying for a car, but she gets all the equity rather than getting just the portion.
Well, he had been paying for it up to that point is what you're saying.
Yes.
Yeah, but you didn't challenge that. No one appealed the dissolution judgment itself.
At the time, it was Attorney John Rob Hill, and I believe that he was going by the chart. And when I spoke with Mr. Rob Hill, everyone's belief was that the intentions of Judge Wall at the time were that chart on paragraph 134 was what divided the parties' assets and debts.
But there's nothing in that chart that says wife should pay him back for the amounts that were paid on the Mazda loan during or under the temporary order, is there?
That's correct. There is nothing in that chart that says that. However, it gives her all the equity in that vehicle.
That doesn't seem all that unusual. I mean, sometimes one or the other of the parties is required to make the house payments during the pendency of the dissolution, or make the car payments, or make the credit card payments. And then at the end, you divide things up, but you ordinarily don't go back in time and say, oh, and by the way, we're going to reallocate the house payments that were made over the last year.
Right, but I think she got the...
Or if you do, you say so.
But she got the equity from what the car was initially worth, not the equity post all those payments in that chart. I understand your argument as well, Judge.
It's not really an argument. It's an observation that there's nothing in the chart that says she owes him back for those Mazda payments.
That's correct. But the chart does indicate that she is responsible for those taxes.
Once again, you can make the inference, but nobody brought that to Judge Wall's attention and said, gee, we're all making contrary inferences from that table. Could you please clarify?
In the spring of 2018... Judge Bridget Sullivan wanted to speak with
18,
Judge Wall.
Yes, indeed, but not at the time.
You are correct about that,
No one appealed from it.
Correct. I mean, give or take the Mazda, our main concern are those taxes, because that's a much larger sum of money. It's $32,500, and she was allocated that debt. It was paid out of my client's non-marital funds, and he'd like to be reimbursed for that. If she would like equity in things, she should also be responsible for the debts that were incurred during the course of the marriage. I mean, everything that's in the chart does not carry over into the conclusions of law either. So that would mean that he wouldn't be responsible to give her equity in things which he has or have paid some of the other debts if that was the case. I think Judge Wall... His intention was that chart summarizes all of, in which he specifically says, summarizes an equal distribution of the party's marital assets and debts. I mean, according to the case of Nelson versus Quaid, if the court finds that anything is conflicting or ambiguous, then it should be remanded. And I think if this gets remanded, it should be remanded back to Judge Wall, because we would learn his intentions as to what he specifically thought in this matter. May I reserve the rest of my time?
You have 5 minutes whether you reserve it or not.
Okay.
So
I have a question.
Oh, go ahead.
Counsel, don't conclusions of law trump findings of fact?
I think that's all read together, Your Honor. I mean, at the time, if there's conflicting information...
Well, I'm saying if the findings are inconsistent, don't the conclusions control?
I don't believe they do. I think the findings are the findings.
Okay.
But I don't believe in this matter anything in the conclusions of law trumps those findings. In particular, they support them by saying that any future tax payments he would be responsible for.
Okay. All right. You will have 5 minutes on rebuttal if you want to use that time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Rhea Bornman Spears on behalf of Ms. Tiffany Lindquist, formerly known as Tiffany Banerjee. I'm going to start with the question that was just asked regarding the conclusions of law trumping the findings. Absolutely. That's the order portion. Everyone knows that that's the portion you rely on if there's any inconsistencies.
Is there an inconsistency where the conclusions of law simply don't address a particular finding of fact?
There may be, but I know I'm not familiar enough word for word to answer that, but I can tell you that in the order portion, it does say that he will be responsible for any taxes and he will benefit from any refund.
And that is consistent with the findings that about requiring your client to actually participate in signing the tax returns for years 2010 to 2014. And as I understand it, in findings 138 through 141, the court said, yeah, to the extent there's going to be tax liabilities, those are on husband, and tax refunds also would go to husband.
Yes, that's right, Your Honor. And there is also in the record evidence of the opposing counsel offering to my client the benefit of supporting her in an innocent spouse claim. That was one thing that was discussed, which would be further proof that they acknowledged that she wouldn't be responsible for any obligation. And
well,
that,
any in addition to what, I mean, as I asked counsel for her husband, I mean, the 2014 payments, although returns hadn't been filed, those payments were made prior to the dissolution. So they were already debts, if you will, or payments made out of marital funds that had to be distributed between the parties upon their divorce, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And, of course, I would dispute what counsel said that they were paid out of non-marital funds. That's the first time I've heard that argument.
Well, and again, nobody appealed the judgment.
Right.
And it's not, it's undisputed that, in fact, husband had made those payments
right.
already, which and is why they were divided. To the extent after they filed returns, there were more tax responsibilities. That was the open question, and that was the potential liability that husband was handed as a result of the dissolution judgment.
Yes. And furthermore, there's the practical side to things, which is that my client was a homemaker. She was not working. So she didn't have an income to have paid those taxes. So had...
And she's not responsible, it does it?
I understand as far as the division of the assets and coming to that equitable conclusion. She still maintains a responsibility. But as far as her having been able to turn over income to contribute to that debt, as I believe Mr. Banerjee has regularly implied she should have been responsible for, that would have been an impossibility. So I'm just making reference to that fact. But yes, we do believe that Judge Wall put very careful consideration into all of this with the equitable distribution. And just like the court already has asked about or inquired about, there was no appeal. And there was a second round. The J&D came out in 20...
Your client didn't appeal the fact that you are responsible to pay those taxes for 2014.
My client did not appeal the conclusions, the order from the final J&D. We did do a reconsideration after the 2015, and we had
right.
a motion hearing, which is why we ended up with a 2016 order.
Right, but that didn't go
party,
to these issues that we were talking about in this appeal.
It may have included, I'm not entirely remembering clearly. It may have included some argument again about her not wanting to sign those tax documents, but I believe she may have complied before that. She
that
was.
That had to do more with the innocent spouse and who's
yes.
going to sign than it had to do with this question that we're now talking about.
I believe that's right, Your Honor.
How do I make sense? I'm sorry, did I step on your question?
No, I'm done.
It does look like Judge Wall did put a lot of time and effort and energy to make things as clear as Judge Wall could at that point in time. I need you to tell me what 134 means, then, finding number 134. The court finds that the following table summarizes an equitable distribution of the party's marital assets and debts, and then on that table is a debt, two lines of debt to your client for federal income tax and state income tax. What does that mean?
Well, Your Honor, I think that that is evidence that judges make mistakes, which we all know to be true, and some are worse.
Wait a minute. No, I understand that. But
I do believe he copied and pasted it from the proposed findings of Mr. Banerjee, which I think is why they are so focused on getting that to become law, this circumvent round.
Okay, but
about delayed
let's
way.
Take that as a starting point. Maybe that's true. He copies and pastes it and says, I'm finding that's an equitable arrangement.
And so
don't we have to read the conclusions of law in light of the finding that that was equitable?
Well, obviously, Mr. Banerjee would like you to do that, but I would lead you to what I believe to be the way this should be handled, which is the usual way of the conclusions trumping those findings.
But then we're saying that the conclusion was intended to be inequitable by Judge Wall.
And I do believe that one could see it that way, but I don't know if that's a fair argument. I think that Judge Wall believed his conclusions to be an equitable distribution, and I think that he made a mistake by including something in his chart that he overlooked. And I think that we've had a lot of information in the record to support that throughout the years, but especially it all ends, that question ends with no one appealing it. That order has been in place, and Mr. Banerjee has engaged in self-help instead of following the order. He has not complied. There are several portions of that order that he has not complied with. And even if he were right in that argument, he was supposed to follow the order and ask for remedy in a different way. Instead, he has withheld his obligation, according to the court order, from my client and caused her to spend money and bring the action back and even caused us to come to the Court of Appeals, which I would argue is frivolous in this instance because Judge Sullivan had done her own research as well. We all know that the conclusions and the order portion trumps the findings. No one appealed back then. This is the order. Everyone needs to live with it.
You're talking about trumping of findings. I mean, I think if there's inconsistency, that may be true. But you've cited no case law, no statutes, no law in your brief at all to support that. Is there a case we should turn to for guidance on whether the failure of the conclusions of law to specifically note every aspect of the asset and debt division means that division has no effect, legal effect?
Well, Your Honor, I would have to say that you have stumped me on that because it's one of those things that has become so reliable in my practice that I have lost familiarity with the rule and the case law that supports it. That is what I have become accustomed to and taken for granted to the point that I can't tell you where it comes from.
Does the case law, as you understand it, distinguish between cases where the conclusions actually conflict with some of the findings of fact, particularly within the distribution, equitable distribution of assets and debt, or is that what the case law talks about, or is the case law try to reconcile and deal with the situation where a conclusion doesn't comment on findings?
My experience has been that there is no reconciliation. The order is the order, and that's what will be enforced. And if anybody doesn't like what's in the order, they have remedies to pursue in order to get it corrected. And obviously, if that had been brought to the judge's attention that the two didn't reconcile, he likely would have made a decision correcting one or the other. But no one did that, so we are left with his order. And at this point, my client is trying to enforce it, and we believe that that is the appropriate outcome. And so did Judge Sullivan. And so we asked the court to trust in her discretion. And Judge Wall, this cannot be remanded to him. He's retired. So that's
not retired. But
I'm sorry.
He may
Hennepin
not be
County.
On the family rotation any longer.
Yes, from Hennepin family. Thank you. I'm going to be done unless there are any further questions.
Here's, we have none. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Appellant has 5 minutes if you wish to use that time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I would just like to point out that I don't think that there is any discrepancy, actually, between the conclusions of law and the findings of fact. I don't know what she's talking about reconciling and these conclusions of law. The chart is missing in the conclusions of law, but the only issue that is in contention is whether or not she owes those federal income taxes.
Which doesn't appear anywhere in the conclusions of law.
But neither do some of these other equities or debts.
But all we're talking about right now is who has, what is the effect of that table?
I believe
it doesn't appear anywhere in the conclusions of law.
Then unfortunately, he probably wouldn't owe her any equity in some of the property because that doesn't appear in the conclusions of law either. And so that's where much of these problems stem from.
That nobody appealed the initial judgment.
Correct. And all future motions have been based on that order, that J&D. But we believe that it was his intention to use that chart as a division of the assets between the parties. Otherwise, there's an extreme inequity between the appellant and the respondent in terms of who received what when this matter was over. I understand that there's discretion with the court how marital property is divided, but this would be an extreme injustice to the appellant if the respondent would not be responsible for these taxes, judges. Thank you.
Thank you. The matter is submitted and we'll issue our decision in 90 days. We thank counsel. That is the last matter on our oral calendar for this morning, and so we will be in recess.
All right.